This is the ASC podcast brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. Embracing the mission of excellence, innovation, and scholarship, the ASC is impacting surgical education globally.
This is Mingli Wang and Shruti Kodi, your ASC podcast host. We're excited to chat with our special guest and colleague tonight, Dr. Ezra Schwartz, who's joining us from Canada. So without further delay, Dr. Schwartz, could you tell our audience, you know, a little bit about yourself, your personal and professional background?
First of all, thank you so much for that kind introduction. Good evening, everyone. It's nice to speak with you all. So background, introduction, surgery, narrative medicine. I'll kind of talk on all these things. So as you mentioned, I'm from Canada originally, although I quickly came down to the United States. So I did my undergraduate studies at Tufts University in Boston, which was lovely for me as a learner because I knew I wanted to go into medicine down the line. However, Tufts University has a liberal arts structure, which allowed me to explore a variety of interests while studying my biology and doing the pre-medical requisites, etc. So I was able to explore the arts. I learned silk screening there. I was previously a photographer. I've now returned to photography. It works better with the medical and surgical lifestyle a little bit. But I was able to explore some of my creative sides, do history, really kind of broaden my horizons a little bit. All this to say, when I was completing my undergraduate degree and starting to go towards applying to medicine, I applied to medical schools in the United States and medical schools in Canada. And on the interview trail in the United States, I interviewed at the Columbia Bassett program. And somewhere along that trail, they had mentioned the narrative medicine program at Columbia because they were starting to introduce a flexible time in fourth year where you could explore medical humanities. You could explore some topics that traditionally, actually, let me correct myself, perhaps anciently were associated with medicine, but traditionally were not in a more flexionarian model. And I said, that's really interesting. I understand medicine as being both an art and a science. As cliche as that sounds, it is true. And I wanted to explore that a little bit. So then I attended Columbia University to do a master's in science in narrative medicine, which I'm delighted to be sharing with you this evening and some of the things that I've taken away with that. I brought those lessons to medical school when I returned back to Montreal in Canada, where I went to McGill University for medical school, where I did narrative medicine workshops, traditional workshops, where we studied literature and explored interpretation, explored our relationship between the reader and the work. But I also brought some lessons that I brought close observation workshops to Montreal and the Museum of Fine Arts in Montreal, which is something that I learned and practiced while at Columbia. And very quickly, I'd just like to explain that a little bit, perhaps. When we talk about bias, when we talk about entering a patient's room and starting an encounter, there is a lot of subconscious activity going on. Smells, sights, moods, our history, patient's history, that we bring into that encounter and might flavor that encounter. So the idea is, how can we study some of these biases, some of what Malcolm Gladwell will call these blink reactions, if you've read that Malcolm Gladwell book, and then enter our clinical environment with a little more understanding of ourselves, understanding of these dynamics of what we call the intersubjective encounter, subject being a reader and a piece of literature, be it an observer and a piece of visual art, be it a physician and a patient, or surgeon and a patient, I should say. And museums are a wonderful space to explore some of these ideas because it is much more comfortable and socially appropriate to say, I really don't like this painting, and this is why I think I don't like this painting, rather than saying, I really don't like this clinical encounter right now. Why don't I like this clinical encounter right now when everybody's in the room? So if you can understand yourself, if you can understand those dynamics a little more, unpack them, explore them, and then learn about yourself and how you navigate and guide the dynamics of an intersubjective encounter, you can take it from an environment that is very non-clinical and translate it into the clinical environment and hopefully enter some of those interactions a little more justly. So That is something I learned at the Frick in New York City. I brought that to McGill and did it at McGill, in addition to regular workshops. And I'm actually now back in New York again, so kind of hopping back and forth across the border, where I am a vascular surgery integrated resident at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, New York. So if you are also hearing sirens from my side, that is why. And I've continued my narrative medicine work through podcasting. So it's very appropriate that we're doing this evening. I am one of the many wonderful contributors and editors at the Audible Bleeding podcast, which is an official publication of the Society of Vascular Surgery. And one of my missions there is to introduce narrative medicine topics slowly but surely to the greater vascular surgery audience. So one of the series that I have developed is called the Lost in Translation series, where we focus on what might get lost in translation between physicians and patients. This was all inspired by a talk from Dr. Anita Dua, who's a vascular surgeon at the MGH, at the Vascular Annual Meeting, which is our large conference. This was a few years ago now, maybe 2022, maybe earlier than that, where she described an interaction with a patient in which she was saying, "You must stop smoking." And the patient said, "Smoking is the only thing in my life that gives me joy right now." And what is lost in translation between the two? You know, what is the goal of a vascular surgeon? What is the goal of a person and a patient? And how do we need to work together? And what are we not understanding in this dynamic? And so I've explored that conversation with Dr. Anita Dua and some of her patients. I've spoken to Dr. Rita Sharon, who's the founder of narrative medicine, and Dr. Abraham Fuchs, who unfortunately has passed away since that conversation, but was a big leader in narrative medicine topics, specifically the use of metaphor in medical interactions. And the most recent episode was a discussion with a vascular Ehlers-Danlos patient and Dr. Shireen Shaloub at OHSU about the narratives of a more rare vascular patient illness journey, I would call it, or an illness journey that is not as widely known or shared compared to a peripheral arterial disease or a diabetic foot wound or aneurysms, for example. So that's kind of what I've been doing in vascular surgery and how I've been introducing narrative medicine topics to this surgical field. I know that was a lot.
That's great.
I'd love to talk about it all.
Yeah, no, there's so much there that we can kind of discuss. One of the things that maybe we can start with is you talked about the mindset and the kind of thought process that one approaches art or literature or something, and how you can then translate that to clinical practice. And I'm glad we're having this conversation because I agree, medicine is an art and a science. And I always appreciate when people have different interests and different backgrounds that they bring. But can you talk a little bit about what distinguishes narrative medicine and maybe its framework and its basis from, say, a casual reader or someone who just loves theater, something like that, and what narrative medicine specifically can do both as a formal program and kind of the principles behind it?
Sure. The interesting thing about narrative medicine is it's very hard to nail down. It's very hard to define. In fact, one of the earliest assignments that we had in the program was create an elevator pitch for narrative medicine, because you will be asked what narrative medicine is and you'll have to have a good answer for it. Unfortunately, I've forgotten my elevator pitch for it, but I can try and give it a go. Before I do, there's a wonderful book called The Principles and Practice of Narrative Medicine, or The Principles of Narrative Medicine, that is written by the core faculty of the narrative medicine program when they were developing it. So I would advise readers, if this interests you, to pick it up and just flip through the chapters. Not all of them are necessary. And at the same time, all of them are necessary, but it's a nice thing to peruse. I think there are core principles of narrative medicine, which include social justice, which include literature, which include philosophy. Really, it is about taking the time to sit with an other. And when I say an other, again, that can be a work of literature, a piece of art, a patient, a loved one, a friend, and understanding the dynamics, the intersubjective dynamics of that encounter. So how I am affecting the other, how the other is affecting me. And oftentimes, it's really important to understand how the other is affecting me.
Something from our psychiatry rotations that keeps coming back.
100%. And so I think the thing that is quite unique to narrative medicine is that we study these dynamics not only through literary theory, philosophy, but practice. So we have a creative writing class, which is a core course to the program. I having a visual arts background and general bent have pushed all of my studies into the visual arts and narrative medicine. So if I was to think about how narrative medicine and visual arts really relate, and my definition of that is how practicing visual arts and practicing visual art observation can bring more justice to a clinical encounter. And justice is a broad term, including medical justice. So improving visual attention to detail, practicing things slowly so that I can be quicker later in the clinical environment, taking the time to actually do visual art as a meditative practice so that I am not only healthier mentally when I do approach the hospital, but I can understand medicine with a slightly different idea. I don't know if you have any of you done life drawing perhaps in the past? So drawing of models?
I have not.
as a little hobby on this, as a side hobby. And I really definitely find it kind of therapeutic these days.
Absolutely.
And have been really wondering about this question, Ezra, which is, you know, it's been my observation that most people who are interested in narrative medicine are not surgeons. Actually, I have a small group here that I work with to deliver this topic to medical students. And I've been wondering if that's been your observation, and what do you think is the barrier that is there between surgeons and narrative medicine?
Mm-hmm. That's really the crux of the matter. I think that observation is correct. I'm still trying to figure out exactly why. I have ideas, hypotheses. I haven't put them to the test yet. I think the Flexnerian model of surgical education and generally medical education and the Halsted model doesn't create a ton of space for medical humanities in medical education or medical humanities in specifically surgical education and surgical practice. I think the kinds of people that surgery attracts, and this is a big generalization, but those people are very practical in many ways. And as I mentioned before, it's very hard to nail down a definition of narrative medicine. It's very hard to say, if you do narrative medicine, your practice will improve by X, or your operative time will decrease by Y, or your safety metrics will increase. It's softer than that. It's a little more ethereal. And I think that people who practice psychiatry, family medicine, might understand that a little more. Not to say that surgery doesn't, you know, I'm here, I have many colleagues in surgery as well that have done the narrative medicine path, and it's glad to see that this community is growing. I think it just has to do a little bit with our culture. That culture is changing. We've seen that culture change in the past 5, 10, 15 years, and so there will be more space, and the medical students graduating from medical school will have more of these interests moving forward. So I think it will get better. Narrative medicine is also a very young field, generally. I think we just need to give it a little bit of time. Right now, I think the people that are having these conversations are the people who know the teachings to be true intrinsically. Is that a question of faith? I think so. And it's really hard to have people who are outside of the faith come into the faith. That's why conversations like this are very important. And the time to have conversations like this are very important. But it is a little bit of an act of faith to say, I don't know how this is going to work, but that doesn't mean it won't. One of my mentors in my medical education master's in the world of medical education, Dr. Martin Pusick at Boston Children's, said something a while ago that's really, really stuck with me. He said, let me see if I can nail this down. It is hard to understand the effects of a drop of water in a pond, but that doesn't mean there aren't ripples. Or it's hard to measure the effect of a ripple in a pond, but there is a ripple. And I think that's kind of what narrative medicine is right now. We are moving towards patient-centered metrics, outcome measures. Now, what is important to the patient in this discussion? That is very narrative medicine-y, saying, what is the patient looking for and how can we work towards that? In addition to, what is the science looking for and how can we move towards that? So again, I think that's a ripple. I think they're very much related to narrative medicine, or PROMs are very related to narrative medicine. I think that that might be the foot in the door method to introducing narrative medicine to surgeons, saying, believe in this or not, you're already kind of doing it with PROMs, and it's in the literature and it matters and we can publish it. This goes into a bigger conversation. Narrative medicine, while it can be quantitatively researched, is really a qualitative field. And qualitative research, be it education or narrative medicine, has a space in surgery, but it's a small one. I want to see it grow. I'm actively trying to help it grow. Now we can get into certain discussions about qualitative and educational research going into the open access journals and daughter journals of larger journals and requiring author fees and what have you, and that not necessarily helping narrative medicine enter surgery. That's maybe a bigger conversation than right now, but I think this is how narrative medicine is fitting into surgical education, some of the obstacles that narrative medicine faces as it tries to find its place in surgical education. But there is promise because it is there. It is existing in ways that are obvious, such as this discussion right now on a podcast, which is very conducive to sharing narrative medicine practices and PROMs and how we interact with patients now in our culture as it's evolving.
Right. I can definitely share my own experience with that as well in terms of the relative lack of surgeon involvement. I'm not sure how many people are aware, but Columbia not only has a master's and a certificate program, but they also hold, I believe it's twice a year, weekend workshops in narrative medicine. And so I attended that. It was wonderful. I had a great experience. But I believe out of the 100 or so attendees, I was a general surgery resident. There was a neurosurgeon who either had retired or was kind of taking a step back from practice, and a surgical PA. And out of the 100, we were the only folks from surgery. There were, you know, chaplains and psychologists and all kinds of other representation, but very few surgeons. So I think that is definitely a space where we can improve the education. And something you said, Ezra, I think is true, that surgeons are very like specific and task oriented. And so a field that is a little bit more ethereal, I think you called it, it's hard to measure what is the direct impact, like how will doing X get me towards Y? And a lot of the time as surgeons is spent in the OR, where you're not necessarily relying on, I mean, of course, there's team communication and dynamics with your team members, but you're not necessarily relying on the physician-patient relationship. But potentially an area that might help to target more towards surgeons is this developing observation, the power of observation, and kind of spatial awareness, because that is very related to, I think you said you're into photography and kind of visual art and how we can improve our acuity on that. So that might be a potential space for that. And maybe you can share, I don't know if photography is just a hobby or if you've tried to integrate it with your work, if you can share a little bit about kind of the visual component and maybe how that might be more, I don't want to say applicable, but more easily connected to a surgeon's job.
Sure. I think if we were to talk about just visual art generally, we mentioned this quite briefly, but how life drawing classes, first of all, have we done them? Yes, we have. I was doing life drawing classes while doing cadaveric dissection. That relationship was very interesting because you were understanding the body both anatomically, scientifically, and as a form, an artistic form, and how they relate to each other is fantastic. Also, if you think about human history, Michelangelo, as he was carving David, was doing an anatomy. Leonardo da Vinci, anatomist. So the ties are there. Now, as far as photography and how that relates to surgery, practice makes perfect, corny as that sounds. I spend a lot of time looking at perspective, looking to see how am I framing this image? And do I have the right exposure? And now I'm talking about like a anatomical exposure, not camera exposure, but am I looking at what I want to look at? How do I need to move, or what do I need to do to make sure that I'm looking at what I want to look at, how I want to look at it? It also requires a lot of patience, understanding that. I still do photography. I do film photography, black and white, almost exclusively, because I feel that there's a gravitas and a power. But the artistic practice is what's important, because no matter how much you practice, no matter how much you hone, there's always going to be a little degree of imperfection. And that's what makes art. And so I think understanding that we are human, that sometimes imperfection is beautiful, that we can strive for excellence, but perfection is impossible, is very important in surgical training. It is also important in surgery itself. Of course, I mean, perfection is the goal in surgery. I'm not saying don't operate perfectly, but I'm saying that you understand what a practice means, and you can train for a practice in a different sphere and learn lessons where the consequences are much less dire. You're working this part of a brain, or maybe the same parts of your brain, in a much safer space where there's a little more space to explore. I think that's how I relate my visual arts practice, my art, to my training or my profession. Also, I think it gives me something to talk about, or it makes me a little more rounded of a person. so that medicine is a lot of my life. Surgery is a lot of my life, but there are things outside it too that make me a human and I can relate. So doing medical school in Canada, I was able to relate to a lot of vascular surgery patients on fishing. I grew up fishing with my grandfather. I love to go fishing. Now I do many other things, but fishing is still a really important part of my upbringing and culture. Or I was really able to relate with these patients because they just reminded me of a lot of people that I would meet on fishing trips in the country, not just a certain population, but it gave me a lot of exposure. And it meant that I was multifaceted and therefore I could interact with a multifaceted patient population. So I think it's important to do things outside of medicine and surgery, I guess is what I'm saying as well, which I'm sure everyone knows.
It's a good point that kind of anything you do outside of surgery or any hobby or any passion that you pursue, there are going to be ways to relate it to your practice of surgery and vice versa. I'm a big reader and writer, and I often think when I'm in a consult room or in the ER, like you're using close reading skills to try and understand what's going on with the patient, not just in terms of their personality and their life outside of the hospital, but in terms of the diagnosis. And when you're using heuristics and depending on different parts of your brain. And so with photography, you mentioned so many different ways that that applies to surgery.
Not to mention effective communication, clear, concise, effective communication. Going back to the narrative medicine program, if I look at the writing that I did in my undergrad years versus the writing I did coming out of there, entirely different. And errors in hospitals, handoff errors, communication with nursing errors, communication with peer errors, a lot of that comes down to effective communication. As surgeons or surgical trainees, time is the one thing that we don't have. And so being able to use that time effectively, be it whether you're communicating with a peer or creating rapport with a patient and understanding the dynamics of an encounter. These are things that should be practiced slowly and intentionally so that you can bring it to the clinical context. And I want to apologize because it sounds like I'm preaching or I'm talking about things that I think that we all feel intrinsically to be true, but sometimes it takes a little bit of dedicated time and attention to sit with.
So I'll be kind of the naysayer because I've always heard this argument from learners and that, you know, medicine and surgical training is just so busy and so chaotic. Like we're expected to learn technical skills and knowledge, application of knowledge, that there just isn't time. People should just come with these communication skills. They should just come fully able to do all these things. And what's your tip for, you know, surgical educators who may be listening to this podcast and thinking, wow, there's really some value to introducing narrative medicine into the surgery residency curriculum, but how do I overcome the barrier that learners will think this is burdensome? Like we've been mostly talking about you, Shruti. Mm-hmm. We voluntarily have decided to do the things to develop, you know, this ethereal side of ourselves. How do you make it accessible to everybody?
That's a wonderful point. And thank you for broadening the context of this discussion into surgical education. The idea is how are we broadening or really applying this, right?
And how you might, you know, with people's time constraints and all the things we have to learn, how might you maybe right. persuade people that this is worth the attention?
Great, thank you. I remember where I was going with this. The introduction of the multiple mini interview, which was done by McMaster but is now practiced everywhere, was in theory supposed to help highlight applicants who had these skills, quote unquote, intrinsically, creating rapport in a short period of time, getting to the crux of the matter in a short period of time, having action and communication skills and interpretive skills in a short period of time, such that we are already admitting students who know how to do this without us training it. I think there's truth to the idea. I think there's truth to the practice of the multiple mini interview, but to say, okay, we've done it, or someone else has done it, and we don't have to address it, might be a little bit of a failure of medical education. Sorry, that was a little harsh. Is an assumption, and assumptions can be dangerous. Now, we spoke about this a little bit earlier when we were discussing faith. We had a few courses at McGill University in the medical school that were a little more narrative medicine in nature, and some students really bought in, and some students did not at all. And I think this is kind of what we're talking about, of buy-in. How are we going to get buy-in for this, both from faculty and from students? For the ones that have faith in it and understand what we're trying to do, that's fantastic. we already have them. Not saying that we don't need to pay attention to them, but that is not the issue, or that is not the obstacle. The question is, how do we attract those students who might not understand the utility or see the utility of these exercises and either have them start to believe a little bit, or if not believe, remain a non-believer, but hopefully partake in some of these activities, gain something from them, and practice it anyway? That's a very good question. You know, I think it's certainly not by mandating writing a wellness essay that actually leads to decreased wellness, for example. I don't think that's the kind of approach to take for narrative medicine activities. But I do think that a good idea is to have a mandatory course in fourth year, perhaps as students are transitioning to residency, or in second year, as students are starting to transition to the clinical environment. Of course, this is basing this model on kind of a quote-unquote traditional medical school education in North America, that going back, having one of these blocks where students can choose a course to take on X, Y, or Z that has a more humanities bent, narrative medicine bent, some sort of activity that teaches in an environment that is not clinical, but will hone skills that can be translated into the clinical environment. Meaning, people can do a traditional narrative medicine workshop for 4 weeks in a row, once a week, and that is amazing. Let's do that. Or if you are a medical student in New York City, let's do some of these museum-based trips where we look at close observation exercises, and then you get to go to the Met for the first time in 4 years while you've been a medical student here, for example. Or a life drawing class. Or a wilderness camping excursion. These are just things that are coming off the top of my head, but giving experiences or doing these experiences and just having an educator who is able to contextualize skills being learned in an outside environment to the clinical environment, and then giving students the choice of what they would want to do. Therefore, they have the buy-in. And then it's really the educator that guides these students and guides that experience back to the clinical environment. So Shruti, you said that you did a narrative medicine workshop. Fantastic to hear. I'd love to hear all about it. The key to the narrative medicine workshop, in addition to a very good piece of literature, in my experience, has been the leader. Someone to help just nudge the conversation in certain ways and then let the participants build an understanding. But the idea is you have someone there kind of putting up those bowling rails. You're the one bowling, but we're just going to kind of steer it a little bit such that we get to the intended destination. Right? So, how can one, or I'm just now thinking about, I would have loved to have gone camping and had a leader who could have said, bring mindfulness and nature and an understanding of dirt and parasitology, all of this to the clinical environments, right? That would have been lovely. But I think that is an interesting way of doing it. And one day, I intend to be a surgical educator. That is something I would love to advocate for. I know I kind of went on a tangent. So in summary, I think the way of getting buy-in is giving students, trainees, and practicing surgeons the choice of what they want to do, and then having strong educators that have been trained in some sort of narrative medicine workshop or attended something in the narrative medicine world to help guide the lessons learned in these environments that are non-medical back to a medical context would be a way of getting buy-in for those that don't have it already.
Yeah. And you made a great point that, you know, the way to do it is not to have a mandated essay, right? And that everybody has something they're interested in outside of medicine. It could be a hobby, it could be sport, it could be nature, it could be family, it could be whatever it is. Everyone has some kind of interest outside of that, and kind of meeting people where they are and then having a great facilitator, like you mentioned, to then recontextualize that within medical and surgical practice. It's a great point.
Well, I want to thank you, Ezra, for your time with us today. I know personally, I've really learned so much, and really, you have left me with a lot to think about, you know, especially the next time I get together with my facilitators for narrative medicine and considering, you know, meeting people where they're at. It seems like a good 101 principle for any surgical educator. And I hope our listeners enjoyed our time together with Ezra Schwartz tonight. And we'll hope to see you next time on our next ASE podcast. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps up another edition of the ASE podcast, brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. You can check out many great resources on the ASE website at www.surgicaleducation.com. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast series, where we discuss pressing issues in surgical education. We invite you to join the ASC and get involved, and wish you much success in your pursuit of surgical education excellence.